Well, it's always a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this very stimulating place.
Well, I want to talk about some work which I'm in conjunction with June Yeo and Marco Tarzia. And some of you may be wondering where these institutions are. And I can tell you, Saclay is just outside Paris. Now, it's sad to say that physicists, by and large, don't know that much about structural glasses, window glass. It seems to have dropped out of the undergraduate physics syllabus entirely, and graduate students hardly meet it either. And it's a pity, in a way, because glasses are of great technological importance and everyday practical importance. They've been around a long time. They were apparently the glass state was first discovered by the Babylonians, the Iraqis, and there's been a long history of development of glasses, and the Romans used them, and they were known throughout medieval Europe, cathedral windows are made out of glass. But for example, in China, glass was almost unknown, and there are many arguments given as to why, for example, despite being culturally more advanced and technologically more advanced in Europe for millennia, they fell behind in the 17th century. And one of the reasons, many reasons are given, but one of the reasons given was that when glasses were invented in Europe about the time of Galileo, their use spread like wildfire. And this prolonged the working life of administrators and scholars, and this gave Europeans a great sort of step forward. Well, who knows? But there's a long history of glass and glass development, and nowadays the work on glasses has moved really out of physics departments into departments of physical chemistry. And as you might have guessed from this sort of preamble, there's been a lot of early work on glasses. And this is a great complication when you are giving a talk on glasses. There are many, many, many dozens of theories already. And if you have another theory, you're just adding one more to what is already a very large pile. So let me just tell you a few facts about glasses which I'll be needing for this talk. Let's think of a liquid. Think of water. There are two important temperatures for water. There's a temperature at which it boils, which would be 100 degrees, and there's a temperature at which it forms ice, crystallizes. This is Tm. And this is the familiar range of ordinary sensible liquid physics. But liquids can be supercooled below their crystallization temperature. So all this is in the supercooled region. And if you take water, for example, and put it carefully in the fridge in probably a plastic bottle, it's quite easy to induce it to supercool. And if you type into Google supercooled water and look what comes up, you get this very nice video of somebody taking a bottle of supercooled water out of the freezer and giving it a shake, and it just goes ice cloudy immediately. And another experiment which he does is he takes it out and tries to pour it out, and the act of pouring turns it into ice. Now, that's an example of supercooling, but it doesn't really signify that you've got a glass. The glassy situation, the liquids which I'll be talking about are liquids like water, which are very sensitive, very easily turned into crystals. The glasses I'll be talking about are really liquids which are very difficult to crystallize. So the first temperature which one encounters, which is of significance for glass physics, is just below the melting temperature, and I'm going to denote it by TA. And it marks the boundary between where the viscosity behaves rather like that.
You made the distinction between two different classes of liquids.
Yeah.
Which one is you discussing now?
I'm talking about liquids which, when supercooled, are very reluctant to crystallize.
Okay, so it's not water anymore.
No, water is not. It's a familiar substance, but it doesn't really form.
From now on, it's just.
I'm talking about.
Glasses.
I'm talking about molecules which are very reluctant to crystallize. And in the next overhead, I'll be showing you some of the names of these compounds. And they'll mean absolutely nothing to just about everybody in this room, because the chemical with funny dangly bits attached, and these funny dangly bits which stop them easily crystallizing.
Excuse me, what do you mean by reluctant? Is there a way to quantify them?
Oh yes, you can measure the. I mean, they form the crystal by nucleating a little patch of crystal, and if that is an energetically expensive process, then it takes a long, long time for the thermal fluctuations to come along to produce that little patch of crystal required to nucleate. Now, in water, it doesn't take that long. That is why it is so easily crystallized.
Is that really a qualitative difference, or is this another time scale?
Well, it's a dramatic difference in time scales, because everything goes up inside an exponential. There's a barrier height, so energy cost divided by kT. A modest increase in that energy cost produces a huge increase in the time scale from being quite quick to being something which is on the edge of the universe. Now, you can really get dramatic changes with a modest change in that energy barrier. So I'm talking about basically complicated molecules which are reluctant to enter the crystalline phase. And the first temperature which you encounter, which on cooling through TM is this, which I'm calling TA, and it marks the boundary between two different forms of temperature dependence for, say, the viscosity. For temperatures bigger than TA, the viscosity grows rather like it does in a dense gas. You could use the Boltzmann theory, and you get power law growth in the viscosity. But below TA, the growth in viscosity is much more dramatic. It rises exponentially quickly, and I'll be assessing how in a moment, but this is where the behavior is quite different. Here, the theory which you would use is when you consider molecules bumping into each other, just like you would do in simple kinetic theory. But here you have to have a different way of thinking about the problem. You think in terms of an energy landscape in which you have to sort of move some molecules out of the way before other molecules can move. So the energy costs, and you get this kind of activated dynamic. And then, as you cool down, it's another significant temperature, which is not really that significant. It's called TG, and it's called the glass transition temperature. And it is not that significant in absolute terms. It is just the temperature at which the viscosity of the liquid reaches 10 to the 12 poise, or the relaxation time, if you map it into a relaxation time, becomes about 100 seconds. It's a human time scale. The motion has got very sluggish by the time you get to G. As you continue to cool, there's a sort of fictitious temperature, and I'll say why it's fictitious, called the Kaltzmann temperature TK. And this is the temperature at which the apparent entropy of the liquid will be far below that of the crystal. And Kaltzmann thought this was a paradox, so TK is the Kaltzmann temperature. I'll be saying more about that. As you keep on cooling, you enter the amorphous solid phase, and there's just really like a crystal, but with the atoms sort of not sitting in regular positions, and it has a Debye temperature rather like a crystal does. As you keep on cooling further, you get to the region of very low temperatures of cryogenic anomalies, where there are atoms which can't decide which of two positions they want to sit. They tunnel backwards and forwards quantum mechanically between these positions, and they give rise to interesting low temperature specific heats and effects in the thermal conductivity. And at even lower temperatures, right in the millikelvin temperature range, where you think there'd be absolutely nothing left of interest, there are some very, very weird effects. You can model these quantum mechanical tunneling centers of spins. The atom's in one position, the spin is up, it's in the other position, it is down. If it looks as though at millikelvin temperatures, these spins might actually order into some exotic phase. But this is the main controversial. But strange things happen at exceedingly low temperatures. Now, these are the basic features of glasses and liquids. I'll tell you more about them in a moment. But there have been a lot of theories around I'm only going to talk about what goes on in this region here, where the dynamics is activated. The region above TA I'm not going to discuss, because it is well described by a theory called low coupling theory, which is the main controversial, because it's an ad hoc approximation. But I've got nothing new to say about that. And I'm going to talk about the glass transition region down here. And there are literally, as I've said, dozens of theories of glasses. On the coast of California alone, there are three rival theories. In Berkeley, there's David Chandler, who's got a theory called, based on what are called kinetically constrained models, and these focus on the dynamics of, well, let's say, defects which move around, and they are very interesting. They can explain quite a number of dynamical features, but their failing is that they're very poor at explaining features connected with the Kauffman temperature and the large amounts of changes which we see in the entropy. In Santa Barbara, there's Jim Langer's theory, which is sort of a string theory of the excitation. I'm trying to make it sound really exciting. And this is an idea which models the shape of the excitation regions. You see chains of motion of the atoms, which look a bit like strings. Yes. It's a theory of that effect. But further down, in San Diego, there's Peter Walliners, who's got, well, what he calls the theory of glasses. The more modest title is the random first order transition theory. So it's rather misnamed, because there's no first order transition in his theory in its current form. But this is a very ambitious program which he's got, which explains a great many features. And I think in a way, you could refer to it as a standard model of glass. No? Well, in his opinion, certainly.
In his opinion?
Yes. Okay. So, but at the same time, there are so many theories, it is a very fashionable subject. For example, if most of us were to send in a paper to Science or Nature, the editors would write back to you immediately saying, thank you very much for sending the paper, but they would advise you to submit it to a more suitable journal than Nature or Science. If you send in a paper to Science or Nature on glasses, it's in with the chance of being published. And in fact, Science magazine, for its 125th anniversary, published a list of 125 scientific problems which ought to be solved in the next 25 years. And I can't remember many of them, most of them are biological. Number two was, I think, the question, what we're going to do when the oil runs out. Anyway, number 85 was the glass transition problem. Can we understand what the atoms and molecules are doing in the vicinity of glass transition? So it's up there with, you know, curing cancer and sorting out what we're going to do when the oil's gone. Anyway, just about everything I say, there are people who would disagree with what I'm saying, but I want to make one point. There are people who believe there are phase transitions near TA and have models which have them. There are people who have phase transition models at near this temperature. But fortunately, everyone is agreed there is no phase transition at the glass transition temperature, which is kind of confusing notation. This is where you'd expect it to be a transition, but if a human temperature, 100 seconds, is just about time to dash out and get a coffee. It's sort of that, it's set by that kind of time scale. Okay. Now, this is the... Those of you who are basically mathematicians will be truly appalled, I think, by what's on here. This is the plot, it's called an angel plot, not after angels, which sort of could be heavenly beings, but after Professor Angel of Tempe, Arizona. And he found this way of plotting a huge array of data on the viscosity of a wide variety of liquids, which form glasses. Now, at the glass transition temperature, the viscosity reaches 10 to the 12. So he divided the Tg, that temperature divided by T, and then plotted the log of the viscosity measured in points. So at when this is 12, all the curves have to run together by construction. And he divided glasses into two varieties, strong glasses and fragile glasses. The fragile glasses have a behavior which rises sharply, whereas the strong glasses don't. And this corresponds to a simple Arrhenius behavior. And the window glass, silica, has this kind of behavior, whereas these molecular glasses have this more rapid rise than in the strong glass. So this feature of this rapid rise, faster than Arrhenius, is one of the main problems which one has to try and understand for glass theory.
So, but further register, it's still linear behavior on this plot, so it's Arrhenius.
Well, if you like, but if you're over the whole range, it changed quite a lot. And if you look at the specific heats, here's part of the specific heat divided by that of the crystal. So below the glass transition, where it's essentially amorphous solid, you get this ratio merely being 1. But then once you've got past Tg and the molecules can move around and flex and so on, there's this big jump in the specific heat by quite a striking amount, and then it sort of flattens off. But just look at the names of these compounds. O-terphenyl. I didn't say it right. Glycerol. I mean, who here knows the formulae of these compounds? None of us. Well, there's always going to be somebody. I suppose, Gilles, you probably know what it is. But the reason why these are complicated is that they have to be funny-shaped and flexible to stop this easy crystallization. Spheres can be easily crystallized, whereas these bendable molecules just find it hard to discipline themselves to get into a nice regular crystalline array.
Is there a characteristic value of the viscosity which corresponds to the higher temperature
TA
crossover that you have in your picture? Yeah.
Well, I ask Gilles at this point for his input.
not quite. It's in the region of around zero, basically.
philosophy.
So it's somewhere down here, is it?
Okay. No, not here, no.
Oh.
In the middle.
But not there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where it curves.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Oh yes. I mean, of course, in the liquid it's zero, but that it becomes into an amorphous solid. I mean, you can define a solid as a system which has a non-zero shear modulus at zero wave vector. Yes. I haven't got anything on to show you, but there is huge amounts of such data. This is not an area where we're short of data. This is an area where there's so much data that people make a living by sort of trying to correlate various quantities. So they think, could the Gneisson constant of the amorphous solid be related to the Kauzmann temperature TK? So you get these papers where they plots and they look as though sort of like almost random points, but they draw a straight line and announce this is a good correlation. But there's so much data that, you know, I could spend all my hour talking about data. So all that data which I show you and all the other data can be condensed into a few simple equations. These are the equations of glass phenomenology. And I'll be stating what some of these equations are. And then I'll get into my talk proper, which is to provide a formalism by which I can take the problem of the supercooled liquid and map it by a series of algebraic manipulations into an Ising-Spin glass in a field. Now, an Ising-Spin glass in a field has got quench disorder. It's a very different looking problem. But there's a mathematical connection between the thermodynamics of a supercooled liquid and the thermodynamics and perhaps hopefully the dynamics of a spin glass in a field. And then, having done that, I will use ideas which are around for spin glasses to try and understand the properties of real structural glasses. And this is a big step forward, because whereas there are dozens of theories of glasses, there's only two competing theories for spin glasses. There's the droplet picture and there's the replica symmetry gradient picture. So there's only it's a much easier way to perceive. This part of the talk was described by Bill Anderson. I don't know whether anyone's noticed it, but there's, in connection with the ConMat archive, there's something called the Journal Club, where the great and the good of condensed matter physics take it upon themselves to write commentaries on papers which have caught their interest, which are on ConMat. And much to my horror, Phil Anderson took it upon himself to write a comment on one of my papers with Tarsia. And I was in fear and trembling when I noticed he'd written something, because on a previous occasion he described me as one of the nattering nabobs of negativism. I'm not quite sure what it really means, but I'm sure it's not a compliment. So I was expecting the worst. But in fact, he was surprisingly complimentary. But he did say this seemed like black magic, this part of the argument. But the rest of it he described as back-of-the-envelope calculations, which is, I'm not really sure that's good either, but... Okay, so I'm now going to tell you the key features of glass phenomenology, which is what we have to try and understand. Well, all those plots of the viscosity versus temperature can be condensed roughly into this Vogel-Fulcher law. And I think Vogel and Fulcher were working, what, about 1920, was it?
2023.
24. Okay.
20 and 25, two independent pairs.
Okay, right. So it's very, very old data.
Sorry? Because of Anna. This can all help.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to be allowed to worry about who gets the credit, are they? So there's a temperature T0 at which the viscosity apparently diverges, and there's this feed factor here, D, which has got a name, it's called the fragility. And the strong glasses are those glasses for which T0 is zero, and then D times T0 is some constant. So a window glass is with T0 equal to zero, and it's replaced by a constant. So it's a simple Arrhenius activation there. But the fragile glasses have a non-zero T0, and this is why the rise in the viscosity is faster than simple Arrhenius. Now, there's one very important feature of glasses which has to be understood. This is the Kautzmann paradox. Now, Kautzmann
can the T0 be identified with any of the temperatures you've shown before?
Yes. I'm going to identify it in a moment with TK. Very simple. Okay. The Kautzmann temperature is defined as where the configurational entropy goes to zero. Now, the configurational entropy is just the difference in entropy between the liquid and the crystal. That's the simplest definition. It needs to be often adjusted.
Experimental?
This is experimental, yes.
So how do they make a crystal if it doesn't want to be a crystal?
Well, you don't, you know, you can make a crystal. There's always many ways to get these things can be crystallized. You know, you can give them inducements to crystallize. So it's not as though they can never be crystallized, they're just reluctant to crystallize. So you can work out what the entropy difference is. And you see that if the temperature falls below TK, this is apparently negative. And this is the paradox, because we think of liquids as being more disordered than crystals. So how can it be that their entropy has become less than that of the crystal? And the temperature at which this seems to happen is TK. And the entropy vanishes in a linear way, and it's lifted the specific heat by a formula which we put in this form here. Now, just as when you're measuring the viscosity, you can't actually do measurements which take T very close to T0, you can't actually produce good measurements of the entropy which takes the right up to TK. So you can't actually explore the vicinity of TK to see what's going on. Now, one of the most striking features of glasses is that this ratio of these fitting parameters, T0 and TK, is always perhaps lying in this range, in other words, nearly the same, for huge numbers of glass formers whose values of TK can vary from, say, 50 to 1,000 K. So there looks to be some correlation between these two. And another thing which has emerged in the last few years is there's now evidence for experiments and simulations that accompanying the glass transition, the phenomenon TG, there is some growing length scale. I'm going to call it L star of T. And not surprising, really. You might think that as you go down in temperature, you have to sort of move around larger and larger groups of molecules to get any flow at all. But it's not that big, this length scale. Measurements indicate the order of 6 particle diameter. So it's not a long length scale, but it's not either a short length scale. It's sort of annoyingly the other.
Can I ask? So it's obvious what the problem is about measuring viscosity as you go down in temperature, but I don't see why it's hard to measure the entropy as you get close to the Kautzmann temperature.
Well, you can measure. I'll just show you the next bit that may explain what's going on here. This is the entropy of something called Salol, which is what? Do you know what it is, Jill?
Which is what?
What is Salol?
It's an organic liquid.
Yeah. It's not aspirin by any chance. Anyway, it doesn't matter, does it? It's just a chemical. Look at the entropy versus temperature. These black dots are the entropy. Now, so you come down here, but the longer you wait, the more you equilibrate, the further you can go down before you run into the amorphous phase. So you, when it's gone amorphous, solid, the curves go like that. So you can't, TK is down here, you see. So if you wait and cool more slowly, you can push it further and further down. But because of human time scales, you can never take data all the way down to TK. So you always have to give up. Okay, now, Adam and Gibbs, working in the 60s, I think, some 60s, observed, obviously, that if the configurational entropy was behaving in a linear fashion near TK, and the Vogel-Fulcher law demands something which is T minus T zero, you can replot the data as a function of the configurational entropy. And so if you know the viscosity of the time scales, you can work out the configurational entropy, and this is an example of what you get if you do that. That's not very profound, but it's been much used. But another thing which is in their paper, which has always intrigued me.
Open
circles is what you estimate for the configurational entropy by extracting it from this formula. They had in their paper a relationship which has caused a lot of interest, really. They suggested that a configurational entropy times some length scale was of the order of some number, KB log 2. In other words, they had this sort of picture that it was a region of size, linear dimension L star, or volume L star D, for which the configurational entropy per molecule times that volume was of order KB log 2. It was sort of some region which could be rearranged of that size, and it was had two positions for it, of the molecules within it. And this has been an attractive idea to many people, and it reoccurs in a lot of theories.
Is there some reason why it should only be two ways to do it?
No, it seems very strange. Something of order, you know, one would be just as acceptable. So the fourth factor I want to mention here is the divergence of A to the temperature scale T0, the vanishing of the entropy, let's take care of the apparent vanishing, the closeness of these two numbers and the growing length scale. This is suggested to many, many people, and many, many of these theories are like this, that there's somehow behind the glass phenomenon some phase condition, a genuine phase condition, perhaps at a temperature T0 or same thing, TK. Now, it's my belief, based on this mapping to stained glasses, that there is no actual phase transition, at least in a world of less than six dimensions, safely in that world. But many of these theories of glass transitions say the transition is avoided. In other words, there is a transition, but you can never quite get it. Something stops it happening. And this is what happens in the spin glass approach. There is a sort of underlying transition which is cut off. But the length scale at T0, which corresponds to the correlation length of the associated transition, can grow to many, many interparticle distances. But I suspect not that big in reality. So underlying this behavior, there is this suggested phase transition, and that is a feature of one of the theories of Gilles. He has a transition in which there's growing, say, spherical-like particle systems, icosahedral order connected with a packing around each sphere, and this produces some kind of growing length scale, but no genuine phase transition. So there are many theories which have this character of an avoided transition, just that people are focused on different possible mechanisms producing this growing transition. And I would interpret the difference between strong and fragile glasses is that this length scale in the strong glasses never gets that large. Okay. Well, this is where everything starts to go a bit pear-shaped with regards algebra. I want now to talk about the formalism which people have used for describing glasses. It's not my formalism. It's probably invented by, in the first place, by Monosson. It's been developed by Franz and Parisi. D0 is not a party for this collaboration. It's a person. And the SL includes Wallinus. Okay, well, this is all an attempt to construct a sensible starting point for doing calculations. And one does it by focusing on, one sets up two copies of the system. And in each copy, the molecules are identical. Let's imagine that at one particular instant in time, put all the molecules in each copy in matching positions. So we make identical copies of the positions of the particles in the two copies. But of course the molecules can have random velocities. So having started them out in the same positions, they will quickly go in different way. Now, let's imagine that we have some kind of density fluctuation in the first copy and another density fluctuation in the second copy at time t equals zero. And let's ask what will happen if the system is glassy. Well, first of all, if it's liquid and not glassy, these density changes in both copies will quickly just fade away. But if the system is glassy, the feature in the first system will be also found in the second system. So, say I took two bowls made of sort of molasses, and I sort of pushed my finger into one, and I pushed my finger into the other, made a sort of indentation. If it's glassy, that hole will stay a long time. If it was truly glass, it would stay forever. So these kind of overlaps are meant to be a way of discussing whether the system is glassy. So the idea of Franz and Parisi and D0 et al. And Monosson was that what we want to calculate is the constrained partition function. So you choose some PC of R, which is this product, and then calculate the partition function where one integrates over the all the thermal fluctuations in the first system subject to this constraint. And at this point, I always feel a bit uneasy because the next step in this description is to say that what we then want to do is calculate the effective potential, which is the log of this partition function averaged over the density fluctuations, rho 2, in the second copy. And, that's the prescription. And I always feel uneasy because we know that when you have quench disorder, you should always average the log of the partition function. But I've never been 100% convinced that this is the appropriate thing to do. You're certainly at liberty to do it, and I've been using that freedom in this talk. But I always wonder whether there are other prescriptions which one could use if one wanted, and might get interesting answers using that. But I will be using the standard approach, which has been used for getting on for 20 years now. And you see here a log. Well, to make further progress, I'm going to replace log z by z to the n minus 1 divided by n. In other words, I'm going to use the replica trick. And so, yes, already, all is well. But I'd only be using it in the high temperature phase of the system, where it will just really be a guide to doing conservation in the theory. I won't be breaking up like a symmetry or any of the horrors which can come that way. So the next step in the calculation is to make a representation of this delta function.
Why two?
Well, two is enough. You could do three, but it would just, this formalism is going to get complicated. But if you just want to project one system onto another, two is plenty sufficient. You could look at what happens with three, but I don't think you'd learn much more. So I've represented the delta function. You focus on this lambda alpha variable. It appears here and here, linearly up in the exponential. So if I integrate over it, I produce the delta function. To average the log z, I have replicated the system alpha times, where alpha runs from 1 to little n, and I'm going to do the averaging over rho 1 of alpha. This is my little n copies of the first system, needed for the replicative, and then I'm going to average over rho 2. And I'm going to carry out these averages, which appear here over rho 1 alpha and rho 2, by using cumulant averaging. Now, when you do cumulant averaging, you express everything in terms of correlations of the rows. And of course, in principle, you know these quantities from liquid state physics. This is just the pair. This is the structure factor of the liquid. This is the three-point correlation function. But in principle, liquid state physics should be able to provide you with what these correlations are. In fact, of course, they're completely unknown. They're only known badly from simulations and neutron scattering experiments. But in principle, they can be calculated. So you cumulant average, and then when you've done that, you get expressions which look like this, and it goes on, and you get terms involving both alpha and beta. So I've now got rid of the rows, expressed everything in terms of these lambdas.
This assumption already that the symmetry is not broken.
Right? Oh, no.
All terms here.
No, but that's because I ran out of space. There are terms which aren't like that.
And those positions are supposed to be short distance, short distance.
These are just integrated over. These things here. These are correlation functions which fall off quite quickly with separation. There are no long-range correlations in the liquid.
Do we intend to study short-range correlation functions or actually long-range?
Well, these are taken from liquid state theory, and there are no long-range correlations in the liquid, except when it's approaching a phase transition, and there isn't any phase transition which has been approached yet.
I'm sorry, one question. Do you expect, for instance, the following phenomenon, when I fuse two first points.
You sort of look at the same point.
One and two.
It would vanish. Yes, because you can't sit one molecule on top of another, because the potential is so strong. But if you go a little, a few angstroms away, then it's not here.
Anyway, but this limit is regular. We don't expect short.
No, this is all well controlled sort of.
It's common at expansion, and you're not considering high order.
In principle, they're there. I just can't write them. Do you want more formally?
Let's project at small parameter. We don't have it, but what would be possibility?
I'm proceeding in the spirit of Landau-Ginzburg theory and universality classes here. The basic argument is that after this derivation, I will be showing that the glass problem is in the universality class of spin glasses in a field. In other words, I can truncate my theory down to a sort of 5 to the 4th theory, even though we know if you start out from the Ising model, there's 5 to the 6th and 5 to the 8th term. But we know these days, you know, that the game which we play, we know that we can neglect these higher order terms.
So that's in expectation of phase transition and some kind of
law. So to make this idea good, you have to pretend there are some fairly long lengths around.
There's no time, so you assume it's something.
Ah, yes, somebody always asks this question about liquids which are below the freezing temperature of the crystal. Because it always produces this sense of anxiety that, if I really calculated that partition function properly, it would be a crystal. Now, of course, you could have the same sense of anxiety in principle if you try to apply thermodynamics to diamonds, because diamond is only metastable. It should really be graphite, but you wouldn't hesitate really about talking about specific heats of diamond. And I think the mathematics of it all is that when you do these calculations, you're really putting in the features which make it glassy. You don't allow the system to wander into the vicinity of phase space, which is close to the crystal. So even though out there in phase space is a deep well, which the system would like to get into, you don't go near it. So you mimic in your calculation what nature is doing when it doesn't go into the crystalline state. Well, this hollow stuff is nearly over now. You introduce a new variable, Q alpha beta, which defines that product by this delta function here. You see U alpha beta when integrated over enforces that result. This is just an identity. You insert that into the previous stuff, and you trace out the lambda alpha fields, and you get things then in terms of the PCs and U alpha beta. And now you begin to see a structure which is spin glass-like emerging with alpha beta, U alpha, beta alpha, and like this. And there's other terms which I haven't got space to write in. And these coefficients, I want to keep stressing this, A, B, C, and D, can be expressed formally in terms of the properties of the liquid.
Sorry, I'm not really understanding what you're doing there. The lambda alpha, all your project, the conjugate variable to a correlation of density.
Yes.
Now you take the next step, so you have variable which is a correlation of correlation.
Yes, indeed. It's a two of these, yes.
So why are you doing this?
Why? Because I think the appropriate ordering is going to be spin glass like. I mean, you can always do this, and you choose when you're constructing an effective field theory something which has the features which you want. And I think because this system is glassy like, that this is the appropriate thing to do. If I just worked with the lambdas themselves, I'd be having some model like a ferromagnet, which we know wouldn't have the requisite features. So you could, instead of another functional, and I would you could go through the formalism, but it wouldn't do the job. It wouldn't mimic what you're trying to get out. So we carry on down here, and these A, B, C's, and D's can be expressed in terms of these correlation functions. Let's get over that one quickly. But it's important to recognize that if you had a theory of what's going on in the liquid, and say, like Gilles, you believe that the icosahedral order was growing, that would feed into these various correlation functions, and you could still go through all this and set up this kind of formula. Okay, so we're nearly there. We integrate out U alpha beta fields, leaving us with just the Q alpha beta fields and the PC fields, which are the constraints. And the next step is to find where the effects potential is stationary. Now, it always occurs the PC in even power, so there's always a solution which makes the effective potential stationary, in which PC vanishes. And this is the feature which is associated with being the liquid phase. Oh my goodness. let's take that solution, because we want to model what's going on in the liquid rather than the actual glass phase itself, the amorphous solid. And the effective functional is this, when you reduce it to a continuum. This is a very familiar functional. There's a gradient term, there's these quadratic terms, and two sorts of cubic terms. And these coefficients depend, or can depend, on temperature. Now, it's very common to have this term depending on temperature. Normally, in field theories, this is the one which changes sign at the mean field transition temperature. So this often is known to be the temperature dependent. But in this case, these coefficients here might be interesting temperature dependent. And this is a well-studied functional, because it's the one which also arises you studying some artificial models, or piecing models, or pots, spin glasses. You get exactly the same functional. And it has some useful looking features. If that ratio coupling constant is larger than unity, one finds that mean field level, that there are two transitions, a dynamical transition at a temperature, let's call it TA, and at another temperature, TK, there is a transition below which there is a replica symmetry break. Here's a dynamical transition, and the dynamical equations which you have around here are exactly the same as the mode coupling equations of Goetze, which works so well describing real liquid. So at mean field level, this model looks very, very promising. It really does look like glass phenomenology.
So there didn't seem to be any dynamics in the theory which you set up. So
no, there is no dynamics. But if you so what you do is you go back, say, to the P-spin model and write down an equation of motion for the fields in that, and then you can get some dynamics for that. But what, of course, happens beyond mean field theory? Because there's no reason to expect mean field theory should be a good approximation. Mean field theory is only good when there are sort of long-range interactions or longish-range interactions, but there's no reason to think there are any long-range interactions in this problem. So you have to worry about corrections to mean field theory. And for this functional, the corrections are dramatic. For example, the space which exists below TK is destroyed immediately by thermal fluctuations. So it just exists only in mean field theory. The moment you go to any finite dimension, 99 dimensions, it's gone. Same way, the dynamical transition of TA does not exist in any finite dimension, simply because the metastable states, which is what is coupling the system at the mean field level, don't properly exist in finite dimensions. So the moment you go to finite dimensions, everything changes. And this has been borne out by extensive simulations by Kurt Binder, the 10-state POTS model. He found in three dimensions no evidence of TK, no evidence of TA. It's all gone. But when W2 over W1 is less than 1, you see a continuous transition to a glass. And we showed just by going through the machinery of the renormalization group that this whole model maps when you put in these fluctuations about the mean field. It's in the same universality class as the Ising model in a field. And let me just quickly show you the properties of that model. Now, as I said, in spin glasses, there's only two rival theories. If you believe in the droplet picture, you believe the phase diagram looks like this, rather like a ferromagnet. There's a spin glass phase, low temperature TC. But if you believe in the replica symmetry breaking theory, there is a transition in a field. But there are arguments around which suggest that below six dimensions, this is the correct picture. And so I won't consider this possibility any further. I'll just work on the picture which emerges from the droplet theory. So once you put on a field, there is no transition. Because if you cool down like this, you get quite close to this transition here, and length scales and get the principal law. But if you replicate the spin glass Hamiltonian, especially in terms of the true alpha beta field, it looks like this, which looked like the previous one, except we have a cubic term, we've got this linear term here. And there's sort of a hand-waving argument that I give here, which suggests that they will behave similarly, and this term in W2Q alpha beta cubed is very similar to this. I mean, by this little argument here, details don't matter. You don't have to go this way, you can do it properly. You see that H squared does like this coefficient W2. So in the mapping to spin glasses, you choose the field H from the value of the coefficient W2, which you can in principle calculate from liquid state physics. Okay, well, a few minutes I've got left. I want to talk about some numerical studies.
Don't rush it.
Even though we've mapped the problem to a spin glass in a field, because we think the length scales which are appropriate aren't that big, we can't simply use the droplet argument to predict what's going on. We're in some kind of pre-asymptotic region. Now, this is kind of annoying because you can't simply work out the properties of a three-dimensional Ising spin glass in a field just by doing a few simple calculations. You really have to do simulations. And the timescales, which you find when you're doing a Monte Carlo simulation of the problem, very discouraging. They get very long. So what we were forced to do was to study an Ising spin glass in one dimension, where we could actually calculate the correlation length psi and the entropy exactly using decimation, the RG. So we could explore what was going on in this one-dimensional model. So if you look at the entropy as a function of temperature, you get a curve like this. So we get three different curves depending on the field strength. So this is a small field, this is a large field. And you see there's a sort of good linear regime that extrapolates back to some Kaltzmann-like temperature Tk. Apparently, if you only had data up here, you'd think the entropy vanished at some non-zero temperature. At the same time, the correlation length is growing, and it grows and then it saturates at low temperatures. But in the vicinity of this sort of bending point, the data is for the entropy is roughly linear. In one dimension, the Adam-Gibbs relation S times psi to d, which is a constant, and indeed it is roughly constant over quite a range of temperatures. And more importantly, if you study the relaxation times in this system, call it tau, and you plot log T versus the temperature, you get these curves rising rapidly, as you'd expect, and you can actually fit these curves with the Vogel-Fulcher law, in which T0 is equal to the Tk which you've gotten from the entropy. So it just looks like what you see in real glasses. Now, we extract the relaxation times tau from studying the autocorrelation function, and the C of T curves decay to zero.
What's the lowest critical dimension? Is there a lowest critical dimension?
There's no phase transition. So 6 is the lower critical dimension. So 3 and 1 dimension are all way below the lower critical dimension.
That's why you say one dimensional simulation has anything to do with reality.
Yeah, we're only doing it because it's easy, but we don't think the physics will change that much. Because if you're below the lower critical dimension, the low critical dimension is 6, 1, 3, the details will change, but nothing significant. So there's this stretched exponential decay form, and we have worked out what beta is from the data. It's a number which is similar to that which you find in glasses. And the Vogel-Fulcher fit works nicely. But of course, it's all curve fitting. There's no genuine singularity of T0, Tk, but it looks just like the glass data. Well, we couldn't do it in three dimensions because the timescales are prohibitive, but we can do with the Migdal-Kazanov approximation, which works a treat in stained glasses, and we can verify that things like the Adam-Gibbs relationship holds. There's this nice linear regime for the entropy, which extrapolates to zero. The correlation links grow and saturate, which we expect. And while we couldn't get the dynamics, we could make an estimate of the barriers, and they seem to be growing in a way which would give you back the Virgo Fulcher law, though, because we haven't got dynamics done directly, we couldn't be certain of that. Now, part of the glass phenomenology, bits which I haven't told you about, is that these various quantities, like the jump in the specific heat and the fragility D, are correlated, and the correlation is that delta Cp goes like 1 over D, and the data looks to be behaving somewhat similarly. Stretched exponential exponent beta depends on D in much the same way as it seems in real glass. So it looks as though you can do quite a good job on getting results which look like real glass results from this mapping to spin glasses. So let me just... It's all numerics, yeah. It'd be great to have a way of calculating. But not in a field, did you? Did you extract the value of theta? Yes. Well, it'd be interesting to see if one can extract. Well, I didn't show you the dependence on TW. Yeah. Okay, but I just want to, I'm running out of time, say that this functionality can be set up, starting from liquid state theory, just by algebra, which maps it into an Eisenstein glass problem in a field. And then we can show that there are growing length scales, and we can explain some of the features of glasses very simply. And because we don't actually get into the true long length scale regime, which is described by the Doppler scaling argument, you're in this pre-asymptotic regime. You find these simple fits, which people have used in the past, seem to be working well in that regime. And in order to make it a 100% satisfactory story, we would, of course, have to do simulations on the three-dimensional Eisenstein glass in the field. And I think to be a 100% success, we have to explain every single fact to do with glasses. So I think we're in business for some time. But I'm quite encouraged at the moment. I think so far so good is my feeling. Okay, thank you very much.
Could you remind what's the role of the H in the Eisenstein magnetic field? What it translates into the
if you have H equals zero, this term here.
Which one? Sorry.
This term here is missing. It disappears.
This H squared H is the Eisenstein
glass. Yes, that's the Eisenstein. That's the field of the Eisenstein glass. Now, this is a term which is there's something very neat here. This term is a trace over the indices. This is a trace over the indices. This is a trace over the indices. But this just sum over everything. So it breaks a kind of symmetry. And this term here. This term here also breaks that kind of symmetry. So the field breaks the symmetry, and that is why the two are related.
It seems that one dimensional plane, really, right? It's a good representative.
In one dimension, it's equivalent to this model here. Yeah.
But in general question, in which extent information which we would like to know about spin glass contains in two-point and three-point correlation functions? Does the seventh-point correlation function bring some new information?
So if you looked at you're saying if you looked at higher order correlation functions, what could you learn? But
yeah, are they necessary to, are they clearly important information?
Well, I think, well, we don't know because we've never had them, so we don't know what's in these quantities. But I think, in principle, for a full characterization of a problem, you need the endpoint functions. But experimentalists can't measure them. Theorists can't calculate them. So we just don't know what's out there, really. But at the moment, we can't do any good calculations for the correlation functions of a three-dimensional spin glass. All we can do is numerical work. There's no analytic work which gives a reasonable approximation. Other than these simple, crude renormalization group procedures like the Migdal-Kazanov approximation, which is very easy to do, very hard to justify, but it works amazingly well, as judged by what you get when you compare it with simulation.
So basically, my question is just raising the question whether local correlation functions is a good description of physics which spin-less.
Well, I think the correlations. Yes, well, in zero field, there is a genuine spin glass transition in three dimensions. And below the transition temperature, the correlations have power law decay. So a local description is not then useful. The correlations in zero field fall off like distance to an exponent. We don't know how to calculate that exponent. We have numerical estimates. In a field, though, that power law is cut off at this length scale, L0 of t. So you get power law up to this length scale. Then it's an exponential decay thereafter. So that's sort of the basic structure of correlations in these systems. Okay.
It's really quite interesting. I'm trying to sort out just exactly what you've done. You start with some sort of liquid theory that you then use a replica kind of a trick in order to turn it into a theory that looks like a spin glass.
Yeah.
But not the question that's been in there, one of the reasons that I got involved in this at all, which has only been rather briefly, is that that always just struck me as being tough. I could never figure out where the physics of, say, frustrated interactions or things like that in the liquid theory were coming in, and then all of a sudden you're in a regime where you're doing mean field theory where the exact results are always your infinite range kinds of systems.
I know exactly what you mean, because I used to have the same puzzlement. Well, it was the realization that you could actually find... Well, first of all, I think you're referring to the earlier papers of Wallinus, those in the late 80s, Kirkpatrick, Dublai, Wallinus, which just simply wrote down these kind of functionals, which I got to in the end. That's it. And it's only in the last year or so that people, like us, managed to actually even pretend to provide a derivation starting from liquid state theory. I mean, everyone said you could do it, or it must come out, but no one has done it. And you can see what a mess it was. I mean, it wasn't easy. Now you're asking questions about physics, how does the frustration in the spin glass...
Where would you see the difference between a material that is actually going to form a glass and one that is going to... it's not.
Oh, I think the answer lies in these coefficients, W1, W2. For example, a strong glass is the one with a large coefficient W2, which corresponds to a large magnetic field, which means the length scales remain short. Actually, there's another feature which may interest you. When you look at these excitations of a spin glass, the droplets, we know they are fractal. And so when you actually look at concrete examples of small droplets, they are like, they look like lattice animals. They look like string, chains.
You know that on the basis of what?
People like Jean-Philippe Bouchot generated a whole load of these things.
Oh.
And so we know what these look like. There may be other similarities which are quite interesting in connection to the actual shapes of the excitation region.
How do you get the dynamics here?
Remind
me again. So you start from this Hamiltonian and you just do a Lagrange approach and just say that it's.
Well, yes. I mean, all I did was thermodynamics. So in principle, I can't say anything at all about dynamics. I started out with liquid theory which didn't have any dynamics in it, and I went to a spring glass functional which doesn't have any dynamics in it. So I can't in principle therefore say anything about dynamics. But because we're in this regime where the motion is activated, and so does, you think of some kind of landscape. And somewhere within this landscape sits the equilibrium state. You think that, you know, the hills and valleys which you have to get over and which are contained in thermodynamics would be the same kind of hills and valleys which affect dynamics. So there's a loose connection between what I'm doing and dynamics. You make another assumption that the spring glass analogy will be useful for dynamics, but I don't think it will be any use at these higher temperatures when the dynamics is not thermally activated. You know, in the temperature above TA, the Mölkow coupling regime, where there are no barriers being climbed, I don't think it can possibly be of any use in that regime.
But when you do get a time scale, right? Yeah. You do get tau, how do you get the.
Where can Alex depend on the Eisenhower?
Yeah, we can leave this discussion for the specialists. Is there any more general questions?
I had a general question. Let's assume that I accept that spin classes and real classes in the same universality class.
Yeah.
But still it's a dictionary for coming from one to the other. And in principle you have one, but can you really now, for example, identify which properties are linked to which, let's say, properties of correlation functions in spin classes? I mean, what would you need to, let's assume you would be able to compute to solve a spin class. What would you really need in order to extract a given property for a class? This is something I didn't really.
Yes, I mean, it's just complicated. I mean, the machinery is there within the formalism for answering the questions, but it doesn't provide any simple.
There's nothing simple. Some simple correlation functions.
You can't point to. All you can measure in liquids are density correlation functions. There's no particularly simple mapping here, because remember, in the first lines of the formalism, I was integrating out the density. So the variables which are left are variables which are conjugate to these. So it does get.
If I would have now the knowledge of all Green's functions in the spin liquid, would it allow me in some simple way to extract the properties of the glass?
But it's all a matter of cultural acclimatization. I mean, for example, what we know about a density, so the variable which is conjugate to density is the chemical potential. You know, you can't see the chemical potential, but you get quite used after a bit to working with chemical potentials and their gradients. You know, who would think, you know, they don't really exist except in your own mind, but it seemed real after you'd worked on them for a bit.
That's fine. It's just a very simple question. Assume I could provide you, let's say, correlation functions in spin classes. Would you, in a simple way, be able to extract glass properties from that?
I think so, yes.
Yes.
So not in a simple way, but in a way.
But there is a one-to-one correspondence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so then thank Mike for the